Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for joining me for the 110th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is Dare to be Remembered. I'm joined by Greg Hoffman, the author of Emotion by Design, Creative Leadership Lessons from a Life at Nike. The publisher is the Hatchett Book Group. Greg is a global brand leader, advisor, speaker, and former Nike chief marketing officer. He's now also the founder and principal of the brand advisory group Modern Arena. He's a branding instructor at the University of Oregon's Lundquist College of Business, as well as a member of the Board of Trustees at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, commonly known as MCAD. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. So start us out, a brief overview of the book, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, Emotion by Design is a guide to help leaders of all levels, whether you're a leader of one or a leader of many, to build strong and powerful emotional bonds between your brand and your audience and between products and people. And I illustrate that through my journey from Nike design intern to Nike chief marketing officer over 27 years. And just maybe one last point is that when I say creative leadership lessons, you don't need to have the word creative or design or innovation in your job title, because I believe everybody has an opportunity to participate in the creative problem solving process.
Well, in fact, in the book, you mentioned that two qualities that are really dear to you are empathy and curiosity. Do you mind speaking to both of those?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe behind every great product or every great story or experience that you have, it starts with a process that emphasizes empathy, because you have to deeply understand and peel back the layers to find the ultimate problem you're trying to solve for your audience, right? And I talk about this idea of seeing what others see, but finding what others don't. Because oftentimes, we're just looking at what's on the surface, an observation or assumption. And so the role of empathy in the creative process is to find a deeper truth that you can reveal through the world, through a product or a story. And then curiosity, of course, is related to that. And that's about finding points of inspiration outside of your what's in front of you and bringing that back into your process and applying it to your process. And that's why one of the examples I use is probably Nike's most revolutionary innovation is Nike Air. And that actually came from an engineer that worked for NASA and was working on astronaut helmets, and came to Nike with a concept that led to creating the airbags that obviously are prevalent today in footwear cushioning. So empathy and curiosity, to me, are the springboards, if you will, that ultimately lead to the best innovations that are the most meaningful and helpful to people.
Sure, and connect to others. I love what you just said. I can remember once, unfortunately, the contrast meeting with someone who was kind of thought of themselves as a hotshot website designer, And they were really interested in eye tracking. They wanted to know where people looked. And I said, well, how about how people feel in response to your designs? He said, why would I care about that? And I went, whoa.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think what separates the best brands from the average brands are the ones that ask that question. How do you want people to feel about themselves when they interact with your brand? Because at the end of the day, the best brands are the ones that empower people and give them confidence and make them feel like they can take on, you know, the world and accomplish their aspirations and dreams.
So on that line, I can't resist but going to the book's title, Emotion by Design. And my question would be, what emotion or emotions are we actually specifically talking about here? Are there certain campaigns, things you were involved with, where a particular emotion was kind of your touchstone, as it were?
Well, it depends on the athlete that you're trying to tell a story about, or the innovation that you're trying to launch into the world. And I believe, you know, it starts with creating a brand personality, meaning what are the different characteristics and traits that you want to express to the world that represent your brand? And then two, what are the tones of voice that you want to speak about these stories and traits? And so obviously you might want to tell a story of a heroic story, and you might express that in a soulful way. And it stirs emotions in a way with your audience that maybe are more reflective. Or you might want to tell a story that, you know, reveals the humor in sport that we can all relate to. And therefore that's going to engage your audience in a different way. But the point is to make sure that you're not using the same tone of voice and expressing the same characteristics every single time the consumer interacts with you, because just like if you and I were having a conversation and every time I showed up, I told the same story in the same way, it would become boring or maybe even annoying. So it's really a mosaic of characteristics and emotions. And it's just choosing the moment and how you want to express yourself as a brand. And ultimately, it's the totality of those moments and interactions that ultimately create that, you know, image and impression of your brand in the world.
You know, I really love that answer. I do think you have to stay open to what the possibilities are and what's the organic fit for a particular campaign or athlete, product, whatever the case may be. One of my favorite books is called The Hero and the Outlaw, and it looks at archetypes and brands in terms of 12 different archetypes drawn from sources from fairy tales to the Bible to mythology, etc. I just think it's a really interesting way to come at the whole idea of personality traits and brand and so forth. And speaking of curiosity, I mean, the fact that Stephen Curry would, you know, apparently all but pass out on the floor at the end of winning the championship here recently. I mean, no one could expect that. I don't think he could expect that, but it's just such a interesting development, such a crowning achievement in his career to take that next championship.
It's a good point, because I think we can all relate to the physical demands and what he gave to himself and what a lot of these athletes give to themselves. And then once they accomplish it, you can actually see also the emotional demands of what it takes to stay in the moment and not let your emotions get in the way of your performance, but instead fuel those. And that's, I think, sometimes, you know, one of my favorite sports is boxing. And the reality is a lot of fighters, as they come to the ring, they drain themselves because they're so emotionally pumped up, and then it leads to a bad performance. And so, you know, I love that you brought that up, because it does show like how important emotion is within performance, not just in sport, but all of us.
You make the point, humans experience emotions. And it is fundamental to our being and our existence. It's the currency that connects us to others. I think that's so important. And it takes me to another thing I wanted to bring up in the book. A couple different times in different ways, you kind of came back to this thing about making sure that branding and marketing does stay human in an era of, you know, you didn't quite say it this way, but in an era of algorithms. You did talk in terms of data-driven marketing. Can you say a bit more about that? Because obviously the landscape has changed a lot, including during your career at Nike. So, you know, what does it look like now? What are the challenges to overcome? How to keep it human?
That's right. Well, I do believe we're in this age of automation when it comes to our relationship with brands. And look, there's a lot of good that's come out of all this data and machine learning and new capabilities and platforms, because we can know our audience in a deeper and more personal way than ever before, and therefore we can serve them better, faster, and on their terms, because at the end of the day, to me, our customer is in charge, as they should be. Now, with that said, although I think technology has given us more, I also think it's given us less in terms of, you know, creativity and innovation and some of the things that are human driven by those human characteristics that, quite frankly, there are not algorithms for. Right? There's no empathy algorithm, as I talked about earlier. And so that's why I say, you know, the process of branding and marketing is an art and a science. And I just feel right now art is maybe being squeezed out of the process a bit. Some of that is due by the push to optimize what you have during the pandemic, right? I mean, there's incredible challenges and pressure on businesses on that. And so oftentimes the idea of taking risks, which is so much a part of innovation, you know, gets put on the shelf as you experience, you know, these downturns on that. So that's why I say in some ways the book is a call to action to remember that it's important to have make sure that the art of brand building has a seat at the table, and that you're infusing your business culture and with you know, the creative side of the right side of the brain, if you will, as well as the left side of the brain, which oftentimes is, and it's not one or the other. I want to make that clear. I mean, you need these individuals and these teams to essentially multiply each other's expertises on that. But it's important for leaders to pull back and look at, you know, their culture from a distance and making sure it's in balance.
Okay. No, I think that's all fair. I'm curious on this point about, you know, knowing how you're making that connection with the consumer, Nike's relationship to market research. And I'll put out there that, you know, I was probably the second person after Daniel Goleman to talk about the importance of the role of emotions in business. So when I launched my company, Sensory Logic, to look at market research, I didn't want the usual methods. I thought they were a bit too rationally oriented. So I wanted to look at emotions. And I made out a hit list when I first started. I said, what's really emotional? I said, well, Disney's emotional. I've done work for Disney. I said, Hallmark's emotional. PetSmart's emotional. I've done work for them. Cars and gambling. And then I came to sports. And yet I'll admit to you that I never did end up getting a meeting, not even a phone call conversation with anyone at Nike. Never could break through. I'm curious as to how Nike approached and understood market research and the ways you handled it.
Sure. Well, certainly during the first good quarter of my career, you know, so much of what we created was built by instinct. Right. And that's kind of just the spirit of the times, you know, when the brand is so hot. And the swoosh brand mark becomes this, you know, symbol of human potential and excellence within sport. And so you're riding this wave. And I think the second half of my career was again this rise of understanding consumer science and consumer behavior. And at the end of the day, understanding that your audience wants credit for what they're doing, what they're buying, how they're being active in your products, They want to be connected to a bigger community of like-minded athletes. And the only way you can achieve this is if you're leaning in to the data science on that. And, you know, you have to make sure that you're building the loyalty and trust. And that's based on, are you truly helping athletes in this case be better than they were the day before? And therefore there's this relationship versus, you know, it's, I'll say it, even though it's said often, but the whole idea is building long-term relationships, not just individual transactions. And so I think that's where this instinct meets analytics. And, of course, some of that is through, everything from marketplace research to reading the signals of the market, but also even mixing that with real conversations and interviews with consumers, you know, on the ground. It just means that, you know, I think not just Nike, but I think the best companies look at their brand as a club and look at their audience as members, because if you do that, you're really not marketing, you're serving, because at the end of the day, your membership has to come with privileges, and you better prove that out.
No, I really love the answer. I think it is about trying to serve a community. You know, we don't go shopping with six strangers from a focus group, but if we can have a conversation that feels relationship oriented, community oriented, I think that's a lot richer. One real tactical thing that I want to go big picture. The tactical thing is, as the landscape has changed in branding and marketing, the mobile phone as the platform, the device, the access point, obviously has gained a lot of importance. What are the challenges, the opportunities? How did you face dealing with, you know, the mobile phone being so front and center in the universe?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would almost illustrate it this way: is pre-smartphone, certainly, you know, oftentimes traditionally advertising even into the 90s and early 2000s was a brand broadcasting their messages at their audience, right? It was one way. And where it evolved is this two-way conversation. And I think the advent of social media and the smartphone allowed your customers and your consumers to play a much greater role in having this level playing field with a brand. And so a brand's job in some ways is to start a conversation, is to be the catalyst. But at the end of the day, it has to involve its audience. And of course, having, you know, that kind of platform in the palm of your hand where your point of view and opinion can matter and have great influence. And so that had a radical effect on the way brands communicate. Now, with that said, oftentimes a lot of the content and storytelling that brands create is somewhat disposable because of the amount they're creating and the cadence, this accelerated cadence of how often they're posting on social media. And so I always emphasize that just because we've evolved in the way we engage and connect with consumers in terms of telling our stories, that it is ultimately important to understand that no matter how small an interaction is or a piece of communication is, it still has to represent your brand story. And so that's why I kind of cringe sometimes when I hear the word content or content distribution, because at the end of the day, what you're doing is you should be telling a story that you want to share. There's a words matter, and I think it certainly matters in culture on that, if that makes sense.
No. And how you frame it and keeping that storyline, you know, cohesive and yet growing. But it does strike me when you speak about accelerated cadence. I mean, you go from the 30-second TV spot to, you know, the video online through the phone might be 15 seconds. It might be 10 seconds. It might just be an image. There's a lot of radical compression going on.
That's right. And you have to keep going back to those fundamental questions. Does this story, even if it's just a line of copy or a product description, does this represent our brand values? Is it expressed in our tone of voice, right? And is it, at the end of the day, helpful and meaningful to your customer's life? And I think sometimes we're moving so fast that we don't stop to ask those questions.
Yeah, no, I really like where you're going with this, because I do think that values is so central. I spent some time recently when I was in Cincinnati to give a speech up at the Cincinnati Design Program. And I was talking to one of the professors there. He said, you know, it's so interesting. We're learning more from our students than they might be learning from us. And one of the things we're learning is this is a very activist generation. And for them, values are absolutely front and center, and they have to be discussed and negotiated and you know, understood and appreciated and respected. So I kind of want to move there in the last several minutes of our interview. One is, of course, the whole notion of working with celebrity athletes can be tricky because their careers can have great moments. They can also have the risk of scandals or down moments. So right now, just to take something right out of the news, we have this Saudi Arabia-backed golf, you know, tour, LIV. If you were still at Nike, how do you think Nike would be looking at this and trying to evaluate how it deals with the whole disruptions going on in the golf universe?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, what is your mission as a brand? In the case of Nike's, it's to, you know, create innovation and inspiration for every athlete in the world, from professional athletes to everyday athletes like you and I. And you, as a, whether you're in marketing or any particular department or division, you know, when you walk through the door, that's what your focus is. And you can't be distracted by the news of the day. And so part of my role always was to make sure that, you know, we came back to our purpose and our promise to the consumer, right? And anytime we veered from that and maybe we're trying to create a commentary that was based on, you know, a specific news moment, if you think about it, then you're just drifting away from your primary role, which is to reveal why a particular innovation will give you superior performance, or you know, what are the unique backstories and journeys that these athletes are on that would. You would find inspirational here. And Dan, I'll say this, you know, at the end of the day, what does the audience, your customer, get out of a story about a rival golf league? It's entertaining. It might be interesting, but in terms of its impact on their own life and their ability to be a better athlete or a golfer or a person, that's what I always ask myself. You know, at the end of the day, my role is to improve, you know, certainly while I was at the Swoosh, was to improve an athlete's life. And so I'm not saying that you have to be under a rock and out of touch with, you know, the biggest newsworthy moments of the day. But at the end of the day, I think your job is much, much bigger than that.
No, I have no argument with what you said. I just know that as I read Sally Jenkins and other people commenting on Greg Norman and Phil Mickelson trying to handle the interview questions, you know, there's been some uncomfortable moments there. Let's just leave it at that.
And time will tell. It's hard to predict how this will all shake out.
But let's go to your backstory, because I think it's an interesting one. I mean, obviously a lot of the great athletes are African American. So you're of, you know, mixed race growing up in Minnesota, which is where I'm based, and not exactly famous despite Prince for championing Black culture. So there had to be a lot of moments of struggle and looking for acceptance, hoping you'd find empathy from the other side while practicing it yourself. I'd be curious, whatever on a personal level you'd like to say about how that informed your journey as you were aiming for, frankly, what proved to be very much superior performance in your career.
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. And yes, certainly growing up in Minnesota in the 70s and 80s, if you will, and being really the only person of color in the room, whether it was at school and as an adoptee, right, growing up in a white family. And so I was always in search of, you know, just trying to fill in the gaps, if you will, in terms of my identity and finding pride in who I was. And of course, I looked at the Black athletes of the time. That gave me that inspiration. And oftentimes the adversity I experienced from a, you know, a racism standpoint, oftentimes drove me to my two passions, you know, and escaping into my art, drawing every day, and sport, because sport's the ultimate level playing field. When you're on that field, everybody's equal, right? And so I found my way into these two twin passions. And then, of course, I see this brand Nike when I'm a teenager putting African Americans in their advertising, which was unheard of at the time in the mid 80s and into the late 80s. And so it's just, you know, this idea that I then went to work for this brand where I was able to combine my two passions of art and sport, and then ultimately take those experiences I had growing up and was allowed to show up in the room, if you will, of business, and evaluate work by drawing on that personal experience. And I think, you know, Nike's always been this brand that's taken a stand on some of the most important social issues of our time. And certainly I was able to be a part of that as it relates to driving racial equality and using the platform of sport, right? And the athlete's voice to try to create positive change in the world through that. So I'm very, honored to have been on that journey. And despite how challenging that childhood was at times, it did lead to the fuel and maybe the tools and the insights that, you know, I'd like to think had an impact on lots of people around the world. And hopefully this book, by illustrating some of those campaigns and moments, will do the same.
Sure. Well, I think this is some of the richest emotional pay dirt, ultimately, you know, this struggle to create community, to look for justice and fairness in how we treat others, the ethical compass that we, you know, exhibit as a person, as a company, as a country. That's, you know, now you're really talking about deep purpose and meaning in what's going on. I'd like to think that in your combination of art and sport, to me, they're very visual. They do involve motion. They do involve motivations. And I always go back to the fact that in Latin, motivation and emotion have the same root word, which is to move, to make something happen. And that's really what you've done with your career and with your book. And I want to thank you so much for having come on the show today. So this has been episode 110, Dare to be Remembered. My guest, Greg Hoffman. He is the author of Emotion by Design, Creative Leadership Lessons from a Life at Nike. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to the New Books Network website, type in Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight in the search bar, and those 100-plus other episodes will pop up. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In this case, I couldn't resist taking one from Muhammad Ali, who said, "Champions aren't made in the gyms. Champions are made from something they have deep inside them, a desire, a dream, a vision." Until next time, take care and be well.